Welcome to Telling Tales.
Before the ayahuasca, before the clear blue skies, and before the great awakening, there were demons disguised as angels.
Okay, everyone, here we are, another edition of Telling Tales. It used to be called Fascinating Talks, now it's called Telling Tales. This is the second interview that I've done. My name's Dave Keenest. Many of you know that. I'm not sure if this is the second one I'll release, but we're filling up the queue with people telling their fascinating tales. So I got this guy here. I call him Bulletproof John. And we'll get to the reason I call him Bulletproof John here in a few, but he's got a fascinating story, a fascinating tale. I met him through a community of people that does really powerful healing, spiritual work together. Healing them from all sorts of different things that we humans find ourselves stricken with. So, hey man, thanks for being here, dude.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. How's your day?
Pretty good. Minus like 4 days of rain.
Rainy day in Encinitas.
Yeah.
We're freaking real. I'm gonna be in Chicago tomorrow, so I'll be wishing I had the rain.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. Cool, man. So, I mean, you got a crazy story. You have a tale to tell. I don't want to give it away. I didn't want to give it away in the intro. I want you to give it away. So why don't you just sort of start where you think is relevant and go from there, man?
All right. You know, I mean, I have a story people like to hear. I mean, it's the only story I know.
Right.
You know, just a little background. You know, I'm from Jersey. I grew up on the East Coast.
Right.
Come from a really good, loving family. You know, I was raised right, good morals, all that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, like many of us, I gravitated towards drugs and alcohol from, you know, and ever since I was little, I always, you know, I never felt like I fit in. And then it was like, when I found drinking a drug, and it was like, like I have arrived, you know, it was like the first time in my life, like I felt normal and okay. And I went hard with it, hard. Like life as I knew it stopped. Like I wasn't one of these guys who went on to accomplish great things in life, you know? Like, as soon as I found that drinking and drugs, I ran with it, and I dedicated every moment of my life to it. You know, I was either thinking about it, hustling about it, you know, I just, every decision I made was based around drinking and drugging. And I got in a lot of trouble, and I, you know, went pretty deep. So I guess you want to jump right into...
Well, not necessarily, man. Like, what... I mean, just share a little bit about, like, what kind of a solution is alcohol for a kid that never really fits in?
My whole life, like, now, like, doing the work on myself, like, my whole life was fear-based. You know, I didn't realize, like, every decision I've ever made was based off fear. You know, and, like, when I drank... It did drugs, it got high, like it removed all those fears. And like, it was the first, I felt okay in my own skin. I felt like I could jump over buildings. Like I could go up to girls, talk. I was good in social situations, you know, it removed all that fear. And I felt normal for the first time in my life. You know, like I wasn't that scared little kid inside, you know, and I had ways like all of us, you know, I had ways of hiding it, you know, I'd overcompensate here. Like I have a very loud personality. So I'd go harder on one part so people wouldn't see my fears, you know, because I never wanted anyone close because I was afraid like they'd find me out. You know, I always kept everyone at arm length away.
Right. So. No, that's how it is, man. Like I was this bravado kind of belligerent type of a guy, but underneath it all, I was a terrified little kid.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I scared my own shadow. My biggest fear was that people would find out,
right?
You know, what a phony I was.
Totally.
You know, I'm off as this cool, calm, collective, loud, funny guy. And I wasn't, man. I was scared shitless.
Right. Yeah, but I was so scared I didn't even realize I was scared.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how scared I was until I quit, until I quit drinking.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't realize, like, any of that stuff either until I stopped and I actually started doing the work on myself and getting, you know, digging a little deeper. I'm like, oh, shit.
Right.
You know? So...
Yeah, man. So what's his way? Like 14, 15, 16, just like the typical age?
Yeah. Yeah. Like 15, something like that. 15, 16. Yeah, about 15, I think. I can't remember exactly.
How old are you now?
Shit, I'm 41.
Damn, dude. I'm pushing 44. It's crazy.
I know. I only look 20, but, you know.
What happens to life? I got no clue, bro. Anyway, so how did things proceed from there, man?
You know, I picked up that first drink. My parents, they saw us heading towards trouble, and they sent me off to Valley Forge Military Academy. And my parents knew I had the ism and alcoholism, you know, and they kept me very sheltered because, you know, it runs in my family. And they shipped me off to Valley Forge, and because at the time I wanted to go to the Marines, and up there is a dumping ground for problem kids. And I got underneath that umbrella of my family, and you know, I gravitated towards all the problem kids. And then I had that first drink, and then it was off to the races, you know. And it was just, you know, it was just you know, slowly progressed. I drank more, I did more drugs, you know. I stopped, you know, I was just home over Thanksgiving, and our living room, they have all these family pictures, and like from 15 or 16 on, like I was in no pictures, like of family vacations or what, you know. Like the only thing I cared about was drinking and drugging. And like I adopted, like I was raised with good morals and values, stuff like that. And like I adopted a lack of morals and values. And I found like the kids who partied like me, and like they all had like super dysfunctional families. And that's the only place I felt at home in their families. You know, I'd come home to a normal family. Like, you know, my parents were at every sporting game. My mom was at, you know, every class trip. She was PTA mom, you know. And, you know, I grew up in a loving family, and it was just like I felt so out of place. And then when I'd go over to my friend's house, you know, I felt normal because it was just dysfunction, and like I could relate with that chaos. And it, like I said, I just never felt like I fit in anywhere. But with all that stuff, I did feel like I fit in. I felt like I finally belonged somewhere.
Right. And you said ism. So it's like I've heard it said that alcoholism begins as soon as you take the alcohol away.
Yeah.
Take the alcohol away, and then you got this freaking ism, and yeah, the ism will make you drink more alcohol or do whatever until you stop it. So what's ism mean to you?
Like I truly believe like I was an alcoholic before I ever picked up a drink. I had like a lot of the traits, a lot of different things, and like even when I first stopped drinking, even every time I tried to stop drinking, like I still had all the isms. I was still doing all the stuff I was doing. Now I can't blame it on the drink or drugs. So it's just like, for me, alcohol was a solution. You know, my problem centers right up here in between my ears, my brain, you know. That's what's wrong with me. Alcohol and drugs weren't a problem for me. To me, they were a solution. It's a solution I can't do. So for me, like I had to do the work on myself to start changing my thinking, because that was my main problem, was my thinking.
Yeah.
And for the type of thinking I had, you know, and the way I felt, alcohol and drugs were the solution for that.
Yeah, totally, man. For me, booze was, it was kind of like the security blanket I had up until I almost started drinking booze. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, this is the new one.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. So, you know, you're like in military school and screwing that shit up. And then where did it go from there?
I came home that summer. I got kicked out of my house for, drinking and drugs. You know, and then I ended up going to, you know, I didn't want to go back up to Valley Forge, and I didn't want to go back to like the regular high school I would have went to. And VOTEC was the first year it was becoming a full-time high school. So like, that's where I went, and I figured it'd be the easiest. And it's funny, I was just messaging, someone messaged me yesterday, and it was a kid I was in school with, and he's like, I'm so glad you're doing good, John, blah, blah, and we're reminiscing about the book. Our high school days. And like, I started that school like 2 weeks late because I had to wait for all the transfer papers. And I walked in that first day of school, and like all those kids who I partied with that summer were all in that school. So it was like, I literally would go one door out the other door. My mom, she would she would drive me to school and watch me walk into school and make sure I got there. But I'd literally walk in one door and out the other door and just go party all day.
Right. Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So then, so this is like, you're still a teenager.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The incident in question, right? Like it's several years later. So just kind of like fast forward. I mean, is it just your typical jails, institutions, that sort of thing?
Fortunately, I never went to jail. I probably should have on several occasions, but you know, small town, right? Last name, you know, the cops thought they were doing my family a favor and they would cut me a lot of breaks. It wasn't that my family tried to pull strings from me. That wasn't the case. The cops are always, you know, trying to do them a favor and stuff like that. But you know, I'd get in trouble and then I'd go back to AA. I landed my first rehab when I was 19. You know, my parents gave me a choice. They're like, if you don't stop, you got to go. And I left. And then my dad, he was going to work, family like passed out in the driveway at like 6 o'clock in the morning.
Right. And so your family says you got to stop, partying or you're going to be homeless and you choose homeless.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. And I ended up going to my first rehab. I got kicked out of there for, fraternizing with a girl. Basically got caught bagging her in the shower and, you know, and see, I never took anything serious. Like right. I never saw the seriousness in there. Everything to me was a joke. And, you know, they sent me over to the halfway house across the street and I got kicked out of there for drinking. And then I ended up in California and I came back home, and that when I was 19, that was the only time I ever had any length of like clean or sober time. I was like one day shy of 10 months and then I picked up a drink. And then for the next umpteen years, you know, it was in and out. Like I couldn't put more than 3 weeks together. And I would try every avenue. I would try like church, whatever, and nothing would work. And, you know, I remember my son, you know, my family too, they'd always threaten me like, if you drink again, like, you're going to be fired, this and that. I'd have to sign contracts. They would never follow through with anything. I would get tripped on, you know, and because they loved me. They wanted the best for me. And I remember when I had my son, I found out I was going to be a father. Actually, this Saturday, he's going to be 15 years old. And I remember, like, I was like, shit. Like, I did not want a kid. Like, I could barely take care of myself. And I remember holding that baby, and I was like, this is it. This kid's going to be saving me, you know? And it wasn't long, man. I was drinking and driving. I lost parental rights to my son. And truthfully, I should never have had any parental rights because every time I had that kid, I endangered his life.
Is that not legally not a father?
Yeah, I lost, like, I have no say over him at all, you know? But through me getting my shit together, like, he's back in my life, you know? And I have no reason to go back to court at this point because, like, we have a good relationship, stuff like that. But yeah,
that's like more irrelevant. That's more of a technicality, the law.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Cool.
So,
because you're his dad.
Yes. Yep. And he knows it. And his mom lets him be in my life, you know, because technically she doesn't have to. Because right. I, you know, but as long as everything goes the way it's going, like, there's no reason to go back to court. So,
because you cleaned your shit up.
Yeah.
Exactly. So how messy did it get exactly?
It got pretty messy. Somewhere in there too, I got married, but not to my son's mom, to another woman. You know, and that was a whole mess. Like, she cleaned up all my messes, all that stuff. And then same thing, like, she was a good woman. And, you know, she's like, if you drink again or do drugs again, I'm done. I'm leaving. Like, on our 1 year wedding anniversary, my parents flew her down to Florida to visit me in rehab. That was our 1 year wedding anniversary. Surprise, hon.
Yeah, totally.
So, like, you know, I got out of that rehab. I came home and she went away on a business trip. And as soon as she left, I started doing drugs and I got caught. And so my family fired me and she left. Everyone finally followed through with their promises.
Right.
And, like, in a way, it was a big relief because, like, I always hid my drinking and drugging because of my family business or her. So, like, everyone's off my back. Now I could go the way I wanted to go. Yeah, and things got pretty bad really fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was unemployable at this point. Like, you know, people would call my family because John Silver, because I was such a huge liability, and no one wanted to touch me if I was drinking or drugging. Basically, I had a pretty horrible reputation. And, you know, December 15th, 2010 rolled around. You know, I just lost another job, and I got hit with this obsession like I knew, like never got hit with before. And I knew I was going to have to do whatever I had to do, go get a drink. And, you know, my family, they had their business, and like about a month or so before like that night, like I went and broke into their business and I robbed their safe. I tried ODing. I bought 30 milligram rock sets, and I ate all of them, and like nothing happened. And
bought 30 what?
Rock sets. It's pain pills, 30 milligram rock sets. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, the blue ones.
Yeah, okay.
And yeah.
Those came around after my heyday.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, so I ate all those, and nothing happened. And fast forward like a month later, you know, I just lost another job. I was laying on the couch, and I knew like I needed to go get a fix. And I knew I was gonna have to do whatever I had to do. And I was like, I'm gonna rob that business again. And I went out there, and I had a hammer. I was trying to smash it. Like, there was a door with just two small, like, glass plates in there. I was trying to break that, but wouldn't break. So I went around to the side, and I smashed one of the windows out there, and I was in crawl through to get into the building. And we had one of the guys who worked for my family. He lived there. And he came down. He's up there with his family. And he came down with a gun because he thought someone was robbing it. And they were, but surprise, it was the owner's son, you know? And he's like, John, he's like, what the fuck are you doing? And I ran, you know, and he called my parents, the cops were called, and everyone was, you know, and I'm still like, I need to get a drink. So I went back to the place I was living, and back east we have Wawa's. And I was like, hey, Matt, don't you need some cigarettes from Wawa? He's like, yeah, yeah. And he's like, gives me 10. I'm like, oh, don't you usually buy like two packs? He's like, yeah. All right. He gives me a 20. So I go right to the liquor store. I buy a bottle. I buy a pack of cigarettes. And then I go to a strip mall parking lot and park my Explorer. And I'm just like, I have all this fear and despair. And I'm just like, shit. Like, I knew I fucked up big time. Like, you know, I really messed up. And at this point too, like, you know, I was a deadbeat dad. I wasn't paying my child support. So I had like stupid warrants out for my arrest for like failure to pay child support, failure to pay tickets, you know? And
when you're that fucked up, you can't see that like, it's pretty simple to sort that shit out if you just look at it.
Yeah, absolutely. When you're so
fucked up, you can't even begin to think about like, how do I get a handle on life? You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Like I had no clue. And at this point, I was sick into such a depression, you know, like where alcohol use and drug use make me feel okay. Like it stopped working somewhere along the line and it turned on me. But, you know, it was like a dysfunctional relationship. It was my first and only true love. You know, I loved it to the end. And when it turned, I still loved it, you know, because that's all I knew. You know, that pain, that sorrow, that despair, you know, happiness, sex, all that stuff scared the shit out of me. Like all that other stuff, even though it was killing me, like I was familiar with it.
Yeah.
And so I'm sitting in that car and, you know, I had a gun you know, was sitting in the passenger seat, and then I moved it into my lap and I loaded it. And, you know, I got people calling me. I got the local cops trying to call me to find out where I'm at, you know, because they wanted to hide me out before like the state cops or sheriffs got me. You know, cops are still even trying to help me out because of my family.
Why were you wanted again?
It was because they knew I had a gun and I just tried robbing my family's business. Okay, yeah. So the cops were called and brought in on everything. And I had like stupid little warrants out for all the other stuff. So like, you know, it was out, you know, and it came out that I had a gun. And so now like the state cops are getting involved and the sheriffs are getting involved. I don't know how everything all transpired to get to that point, like who called who, what was happening. But I just remember listening to messages and saying like, John, let us help you before they get you, this and that. We put you in the hospital. my son's mom, she was sending me text messages saying, John, don't do anything stupid. You know, your father, I mean, your son needs a father, all this stuff. And, you know, I was just like, I drank, you know, and I cracked that bottle, and like all that fear and despair I was in multiplied by like a million, you know, didn't quiet those voices anymore. And
not even for a set, maybe for like a minute or two, literally, if that.
not at all this time around, man. It was just like multiplied it. Like it was like high def stereo, you know.
Best friend turns on you like a motherfucker.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I the only person I did answer the phone for was this guy Virgil. He was my, you know, he was just a family friend. He used to work for my family when we had another business. He tried to help me out through everything. You know, when my parents couldn't handle me, they would send me over to him and stuff like that. And he said I was like 2 minutes away from telling him where I was. And then I said, oh, shit, here comes the cops. Yeah. And later on, I found out the cop, they used the GPS on my iPhone to track me. And it was like a whole parade of state cops and sheriffs coming and get me. And he's like, don't get out of that car with that gun. I said, don't worry, I'm not getting out of this car at all. And I put the gun up like this, and here's my trach. I don't know if you can see it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I put the gun up like this, and I pulled the trigger. And I remember thinking, too, like, before I pulled it, I'm like, this is, like, there's no coming back from that. This is final, you know? But I was just in so much fear and despair, and like, you know, that look of disgust from my parents.
So how old are you at this point? Like 32,
33? It was about 33, 41 now. It was 8 years ago. So right around there. Right. And I remember like that was the hardest movement I ever did. That just that one little movement like that, because I knew like that's final. And honestly, I'm not in my right frame of mind. I pulled the trigger and like the gun went off. And then my next thought was like, oh shit, I don't want to die.
You remember, it was like, the gun go- you remember the sound of the gun going off?
It's about the only part of the night I remember. It was like, and it was like slow motion. The bullet, it shattered my throat, went up through here, and it traveled up.
Right.
And right behind your jawline, in case you have your vertebral artery, and that's the only way your brain gets blood. Mm-hmm. It went through the artery right about there and shattered.
Through the artery.
Yeah, like it hit the artery and shattered that bone.
Right.
And when it did that, it redirected the bullet straight back and lodged in my spine, where it still sits today, my C2 vertebrae. And when it did that, it was like everything went black and it was like lights flickering. And I could feel the life going out from underneath me. And I was like, I'm dead. And when the cops failed me, they failed me slumped over the steering wheel. And the cops, they opened the door, and they at this point they didn't realize I shot myself, and they ripped me out of the car. They slammed me on the ground. They shoved a shotgun in my head, and they're on top of me, and they realized I shot myself, and they saw the blood or whatever, and
you end up paralyzed from that.
Yeah, I could have, right. You know, yeah, so. One of the sheriffs there was the kid I grew up with, and they're all trying to talk to me to keep me conscious, and I kept fading out. And I just remember, I just wanted to go to sleep. It was just so hard to keep my eyes open. And, you know, they rushed me up to the hospital, and they medically induced a coma into me. And I was in there for coma for like 2 weeks or something like that, you know, and the doctors are telling my family, like, all the stuff that's going to be wrong with me. They're like, if your son lives, he's going to be brain dead. Because I had minimal, they don't know how I didn't suffer a massive stroke because I had such minimal blood going in my brain. They're going to be brain, he's going to be brain dead. He'll never eat solid food again because the hole in my throat was so big. I aspirated everything and went, everything I ate went into my lungs or drank. Just going down this whole entire list, my mom went out in the hallway and she prayed right then and there. She's like, God, if you're not going to bring my son out of this hole, just take him now, you know? And because she knew I struggled with life. And if, you know, if I came out as a crippled or like paralyzed from the neck down, because all that stuff was still possible. Right. I mean, it was in such uncharted territories. They, you know, and so that's why they medically induced a coma because they had to figure out what to do with me, because I'm the first recorded case to ever survive. Like, the things the bullet hit inside me, like, no one's ever lived. So I was case study number one. And, you know, they're calling around all these doctors to figure out what to do. They're afraid. Because usually, if, like, cases, they'll go back and look. They're like, all right, we do this, this, and this. And, you know, they didn't know what to do. They're afraid if they did this and this before this, I could be paralyzed. Or this and this, I could be brain dead. So it was kind of like uncharted territory. And I came out of the coma. They brought me out of the coma. I don't remember being in the ICU. I remember coming to on the trauma floor, because when they brought me out of coma, they shot me up with this stuff, that stuff Michael Jackson OD'd from. I forget what it's called. But, you know, my ICU nurse came up to visit me, and I couldn't talk my first for a little while in the hospital because I had a size 8 trach in my throat, so I'd do everything with pen and paper. And she's like, do you remember anything about that night? I'm like, no, I thought I came to on the trauma floor. I didn't realize I came to in the ICU. And she said, I filled up a whole entire notebook of, you know, I was asking her to get me a bottle of whiskey. That was the first thing I wanted when I came to. Not like, before, where am I? What happened?
Before trauma or before?
Yeah, before they moved me up to the trauma floor, I was asking her to get me a bottle of whiskey. And the part I remember is being on the trauma floor. And, you know, I'm laying there and, like, I'm coming out of that haze or whatever they shot me up with. I can't see, and I could start hearing. I hear all these voices around me. I'm like, and I can't talk because of the trach. I literally had tubes coming out of every hole in my body.
Right.
And so my first reaction was I start swinging. I start trying to hit all the nurses. And nurse, she was from Finland. Her first name was Yuta and last name was Man, so everyone called her Yuta Man. She was like 65 years old, and it's like she pinned my arms down like this, and she's like, let me say a prayer for you. And she said a prayer in my ear. And in that second, that moment is like when I came out, like I was able to start seeing again and all that stuff. And it was pretty heavy.
Man.
Yeah.
That's a crazy tale, dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sharing.
Yep.
Wow. And it's crazy. Like the first, me being the way I used to be, I can't imagine wanting anything else other than a bottle of whiskey if I came out of that. And it's kind of both.
Yeah. Yeah.
The cause and the solution.
Yeah. It's what I know.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, what else? Yeah. What else would you wish for?
Yeah. Absolutely.
So this wasn't, I know that after this, like, you kept drinking for a bit, right?
Yeah, I got out of the hospital, and
this wasn't enough to have you be like,
no, absolutely not. I used to lay in the hospital and, like, fantasize about drinking and drugging. Like, I used to cheek all my Percocets. I was on morphine drip, perks, and then they had me on fentanyl patches. I'd, like, suck all the stuff out of fentanyl patches, cheek all the perks, and, like, eat them all at once, you know, every 4 hours hit that buzzer. Totally. And I'd get out. I got out of there, and I started shooting heroin now. You know, I was in pretty bad shape for a while. So that didn't happen right away. My parents got tired of my shit, you know, because I ended up sleeping with one of my trauma nurses when I got out, and my parents came home and they found that. They saw her car parked there. They come upstairs and she's in the bedroom with me, and they threw me out of the house at that point. Like, we're fucking.
How do you manage to throw game?
Good talker.
I can't analyze that one.
Good talker. You know, and then they kicked me out, and I ended up getting this place, and I stayed talking to her like the whole summer, that nurse. It was fun.
I'm sure it was. She's seen you at your worst, no question there. So it's only going up.
Yeah.
Only room to grow or whatever. Well, cool. Yeah. Well, then, there's so many places we can go with all this, dude. But I mean, all I hear is that you're a walking, talking, living, breathing miracle.
Yes.
How about that? Like, sure about, like, you know, the spiritual aspect of this. Now that we got over the raunchy part, like, what?
Yeah.
Like, hear about life and your philosophy and all that.
Yeah. So, like I said, I went back out for another 3.5 years, and like I said, I started shooting heroin, And, you know, my family found me in a cockroach infested hotel room. And I asked for help. And I went to a detox and, you know, I sobered up. And then I went to like a 3-month aftercare place. And, you know, I was just angry. I went to fight everyone. I went to argue with everyone because I was pissed because it was like the first time in my life, like I knew like the gig was up. Like I can't drink and drug anymore. And
killing myself doesn't work either.
Yeah. Right. So I didn't have this spiritual experience yet then because then I moved out to California to get away from Jersey. And I was out in California for a month and I started shooting heroin and meth out here. Right. And, you know, why not? You know, because black tar is on my bucket list. And back east, we have White China. And like, I was like, well, if I'm never going to do heroin the rest of my life, I must try black tar once. Yeah. And that started like a run for like a month. And
you had already been introduced to recovery at this point though?
Yeah. Yes.
A lot of people get introduced to recovery and then they go back out.
Yeah. Yeah. I was first introduced to recovery when I was like 16.
Yeah. Okay, right.
Yeah. Totally. And off that Howard Johnson off Lacadia Ave. Now it's some other name of the hotel. By the time it was a Howard Johnson, I was in there. And, you know, I want to die again. And I'm like, fuck, I fucked it all up again. And I sit on the edge of the bed and I had a needle in my arm. I was going to shoot air in my veins. And I looked up in the mirror and I saw myself for the first time. And I was like, fuck. I was like, I had like one of those moments of clarity. So I'm like, what am I doing? Like, and I called for help and I got into a detox. And, you know, and then like through that detox, I got, the lady who ran it, and she's like, I got the perfect guy for you. His name's Tommy, and he ran a sober living. And she set up an interview with him, and you know, he met with me. And he was warned, I didn't know this, he was warned not to take me. I already started building not a good reputation out here in California.
You wouldn't take you.
No, but when he met with me, he saw I had that gift of desperation. And I was like, man, I said, you know, I was like, if you guys tell me to wear a tutu and pigtails, like I would have done it at that point. Cause like, I always tried to do something my own way. I was always doing something sneaky. You know, that's the whole thing. Like whenever I try getting help or recovery, like I was always doing something sneaky and I always thought I knew what way was best. So I was like, whatever you guys tell me to do, I'll do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And that's what they say. Like you know, there's a big, you know, in recovery, it's like, not my will, God's will, right? Yeah. I will be done, not my will. And thy will, God's will, is what, in the immediate, when you first get sober, yeah. God's will is what all these fucking people are telling you to do.
Yeah.
God's just speaking through those people, and it's like, brush your teeth, make your bed.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I remember, dude, it was like my first day in detox, like when I was finally done. You know what I mean? And like my life had just been completely and totally shattered and annihilated into a million pieces and was staring back at me from like a shattered mirror of the floor. Yeah. You know what I mean? And the only thing that and like I was in this nasty ass detox center in the, you know, north side of Chicago, like all these nasty crack whores. It was disgusting. And you know, and I'm not making myself out to be any better than that at all. Right.
Yeah.
The only thing there was to do was pick up the toothbrush. You know what I mean? And like brush my teeth. That's it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how it started. It started there. And then it like 2 days later, it was like drink a little bit of Gatorade. And then like 2 days after that, it was like eat a peanut butter and jelly, you know? And then after like 10 days, I had an appetite. Yeah. And then I was looking forward to meals after like 2 weeks, you know? And it's gnarly, dude.
Yeah.
The worst.
Absolutely.
But here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Well, yeah, man, I want to start wrapping up. I mean, thanks so much. Just tell me, I mean, you run a sober house today, don't you?
Yes.
That's what I said you wouldn't.
That same guy who I interviewed with, like I, after a year being there, like he had some other business ventures and he was the owner of the business too, but he was moving out and he approached me about, you know, if I wanted to start managing, and I said, absolutely. And yeah, and that was, shit, been coming up on 4 years, almost 4 years of running the house. Now we have two houses.
Right.
Looking for a third location. I'm also alumni director now over at Casa Palmera. It's a big treatment center in Del Mar. And yeah, it's the coolest gift. Like, for me, there's no greater joy than working with these guys, seeing that life come back on. And we have such a rad style because, like, I approach it more as a mentorship. Like, I just give them my time. Because, like, as you know, and I know, like, the most valuable thing you give to one of us, derelicts, is, like, time. And, like, start showing them, like, there's a whole new way of living. And, like, so, you know, I take them surfing, skateboarding, hiking, you know, just start showing them, like, they can live life again.
Yeah, man. I say this before. I mean, I've seen people in Chicago, like, drag their crack and heroin addicted asses, right, into, like, one of the local sobriety hangouts.
Yeah.
Right? And those that are willing, I've seen them completely and totally rebuild their lives into something they couldn't even imagine they'd become in like 2 months, 3 months.
Yeah.
If they're totally willing to start doing the things they don't want to do.
Absolutely.
And then you find out this life thing I've been avoiding for so long is not that hard.
No, it's not.
But it was something that was so crazy. I had to put a gun in my mouth to avoid living it.
Yeah.
The only way I could find out how easy it was to go through all of its hardships.
Yeah. And, like, I don't regret it, you know, like,
totally.
Because it's cool. Now I have this ability, like, I could reach so many more people than the normal person, you know, and it's just like, I don't know. It's a pretty crazy story, you know. Honestly, there's a lot more we didn't get into, but, like, it's the only one I know. So to me, it's just like, it's normal because that's the only life I've ever known. I know nothing else.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we were chatting last week. It's bizarre. Yeah. I forget that the things that happened to me and that I made happen even existed sometimes. And I'm reminded once in a while when I hear people like you speak.
Yeah. And I do a lot of speaking and it's crazy. Like when I'm up at the podium talking and stuff like that, and I'm telling this story, it's like, I'm almost telling it of a different person.
Right. That's how it
turns. I'm so far removed from that person. And it's just like, I'm not that person. It's just like, I'm talking about different people.
Right. And I don't, you know, now without getting into the, you know, the anonymous programs, right. There's an emphasis on amending, changing your behavior. You know, when you've made those amends and you've fessed up for the things that you've done and a lot, and you're committed to not being that way anymore, it's almost like spiritually you aren't the same person anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it requires work to get there. It's not like it just happens. Like, you have to do the work.
Yes. Yeah. And I definitely had, from doing the work, that's where I had my spiritual experience. You know, I had that moment of clarity in that hotel room. And then, you know, getting hooked up with Tommy and our sober living and the people he put me in contact with. And I found some guy, another man who I trusted, which was the case. From doing the work, I had that spiritual experience. And that's been the change for me, is having that spiritual experience. Than all the other times. Because left up to me, you know, me on my very best day did all the stuff I just told you. That's me at my best.
Right.
So, like, all this is, you know, this is not me. You know, it's through God or whatever your own
belief. Power, God. I just call it God now.
Yeah.
It's just a simple one syllable word that works for me. But it's amazing what happens when you see a person go from living with no God to living with a God.
Yeah.
I mean, anything becomes possible. It's just crazy. And then you just have this experience of life that, like, you know, for me and God, like, there's no need for me to even argue the existence or the non-existence of, like, if somebody's an atheist or whatever, it's like, I don't even have a need to go there because it's such a personal thing for me. You know what I mean? I have all the evidence that I need, so much so that I don't even need to defend it.
Absolutely. Right. And, you know, I've had moments through this, like, 4.5, almost 5 years, like, where I've stopped, my connection's been cut off, right. You know, and I've suffered, you know. I've taken some beatings, and, like, not anymore, man. Like,
I know, man.
That's first above anything else, just because, like, my days go so much better, like,
always. And you can reset your days if it starts going bad.
Yeah, because without that spiritual connection, like, I'm fucked.
Right. Like, all that shit they tell you your first time to rehab totally works. It just might not take you 20 years to listen to it.
Yeah.
You know, you can listen the first time. You can shoot yourself in the head, though.
Yeah. They always said I had a hard head.
Yeah, man.
Probably the safest spot to shoot me was my
head. Yeah, right? Damn, dude. All right, brother. Thanks for being here with us today and for everyone who's listening. I got one last question I always ask people, and that's, what can I acknowledge you for, man?
What do you mean? Like,
I'm going to say something nice about you. What do you want me to say?
That my life today is of service. That's been my saving grace. I devote 100% of my life to helping others.
Yeah.
I'm afraid not to. And I, those guys who did that with me, it had such a huge impact on my life. And so, you know, that's what brings me the joy today.
Dude. Yeah, man. And thanks so much. Like, you know, the best servants of God are the ones that just blend in. You know what I mean? Like, they don't stand out. They're just doing their thing quietly and humbly, and they're making a huge difference.
Yeah.
And you're really making an enormous difference in the world, just in like that little house that you run. You know what I mean? And the way that you show up for work on Friday nights at Casa, like, that just, that's all that there is for you to do, really, man. You know? Yeah. So dude, thanks for, I mean, all you've been through. Thanks for coming on, being real, being honest, being vulnerable, being hilarious, all of it, dude. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate you asking me. Thank you.
Yeah, bro. All right, guys. It's been another episode of Telling Tales. We've been talking with John, it's Menz, right? M-E-N-Z. Menz. And, gotcha. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.